Hello, and welcome to the ASB Investment Podcast, the show that keeps you up to date on the market and helps you make smart choices with your investments. These are entirely our own views and that of our guests. It's not investment advice, but we know plenty of experts at ASB that will be happy to chat if you need. Well, welcome to the latest episode of the ASB Investment Podcast. I'm your host once again, Nigel Grant, again in the seat that steers the podcast ship through the great lake of volatility and all the market goings on. So we really hoped you enjoyed our last podcast where we talked about the role of stewardship and responsible investing. And if you haven't had a chance to listen, I would encourage you for that to be next on your list after today's conversation. And for today's conversation, we have two wonderful guests in the studio. The first being our very own ASB Head of Asset Management, the man I get to work with every day and whose personal stock value is at a 52-week high. It's John Smith. How are you, John?
I'm good. Thank you, Nigel.
Do you like my intro?
Lovely. I'm not quite sure how I got to 52-week high, but anyway.
It's what I thought of going with. What's new with you since you were last in the studio?
I suppose it's been a few months. So just from the home front, we got a small lifestyle block, as I think the listeners know. It's spring, so we're very fortunate to have lots of cherry blossom trees. It's just lovely under the cherry blossoms. It's very serene and very relaxing. On the work front, though, really interesting. We just completed the transition of our global equities to a Paris-aligned benchmark, and it's a combination of a lot of work that we've been doing on climate change and the investment risk associated with climate change. It's not a values-based decision; it's an investment decision. It's really just identifying the fact that climate change is happening. There is investment risk and we need to manage it. And so I think that's a really big step for us. You could put a whole other podcast around that particular subject, so I'll stop there.
Sounds like I can feel the next one being set up there.
Indeed.
And our second guest is someone who we've been genuinely looking forward to having on the show for some time. Now, some of you may have heard of or from him before in terms of some of BlackRock or the BII, the BlackRock Investment Institute's commentary around the globe, seen him on the likes of Bloomberg TV. We've had the lucky experience of having this gentleman talk to our staff a number of times as well, including what we've just come from today as well. But we're lucky enough to have him here today in person, all the way from Singapore, the BlackRock Investment Institute's chief investment strategist for Asia Pacific, Mr. Ben Powell. How are you?
Doing very well. Hi, Nigel. Hi, John. Great to be with you. Looking forward to a great discussion today.
Now, I know you're from a while ago. I know you're an avid cricket fan. Is that still the case?
It is. I'm a life member of the MCC. I really love it. Yes, yeah. For sure.
And I just wanted to check in how you were feeling after New Zealand's demolition, or the New Zealand B team somewhat, demolition of England in the opening game of the World Cup.
I loved it. I love New Zealand. I love cricket. So I've never been more excited and happy to see anything. It was great.
That is a professional answer. And in all seriousness, can you seeing it's your first time on the show, let our listeners know specifically more about your role and your responsibilities for BlackRock.
Certainly. So our team, I guess, the BlackRock Investment Institute, were the core independent research function, blending geopolitics, macroeconomics, markets views, sustainability, to John's point earlier, and all of that mixed into what does it mean for portfolios? Right, so that's the only question. Ultimately, there's an awful lot of input, but ultimately, what does it mean for portfolios? So we do the work, if you like, the internal work, and then I guess I've got some responsibility in Asia to communicate our thoughts, our thinking around portfolios, markets, to clients, our key partners, such as yourselves, of course.
And is the best way for listeners to follow some of your work to sign up to what the BII produces? Would that be the best vehicle?
Yeah, I think so. So we try to make it relatively easy to engage with. I'm sure we can always do better, but we have a weekly publication, which has got like a 60 or 80 second video attached to it. And if you were to follow that relatively frequently, you'd be pretty up to date on what the world's largest asset manager is thinking day by day, week by week, which may or may not be useful for you guys out there listening.
And so today's welcome to the show, I should say, particularly. But today's first section, just we'll start with a general what's been going on. And the first question I wanted to ask is, getting to some of the recent topics and events that have been occurring throughout the investment world, I wanted to start with you, Ben, first. I wanted your opinion on the 9 months or nine and a bit months now that we've just gone through so far this calendar year. Has it played out like you were thinking maybe this time in January?
Yes and no. I think I'll take the no bit. We've been a bit surprised, looking back 6 or 9 months, at the power of what has been come to be known as the Magnificent Seven. Right, so this astonishing, obviously AI-related super boom, which has been such a huge driver. So interesting, I think, in general, but specific to your question, Nigel, to markets, right? That seven companies can be kind of more significant than the bottom 493 in an index was, frankly, a little bit surprising to us as we look back, just the scale and pace of that.
Yeah. In the S&P 500, sorry to cut you off.
Yeah, exactly right. Sorry, yeah, that's right. So there's 500 stocks and they're not all the same. Some are bigger than others. And if the big ones do well, that can dominate at the index level. And some of these huge, you know, the behemoths of the internet and other in the US equity market, they've done very, very, very well. And this AI phenomenon, which is really... caught fire, I think, over the last several months. Full disclosure, on January 1, I didn't see that coming to the extent that
it has. And John, your thoughts?
Look, for me, it's been about watching how inflation's played out this year. Last year was a pretty dreadful year. Interest rates going up, markets basically going down. And yet, so we've seen inflation coming off, but then core inflation holding. And the way that the markets are reacting to that, the way the central banks are reacting to that, earlier in the year, the sense that it's all been done and central banks will start lowering interest rates and so the markets can sort of like get some power coming back. And then, no, maybe it isn't under control and, you know, holding interest rates, maybe raising interest rates higher for longer. That dynamic has been very interesting for me. I suppose the sort of like the listeners who've heard me before know that I've got some experience from back in the 70s, 80s and 90s and the inflation there. So it's been interesting to watch because I've experienced it before. And I'd have to say I'm not surprised that inflation is harder to control than it has appeared. So, but yeah, I'm actually really surprised at the markets. And to Ben's point, I suppose it's really, really important to understand that it's not been the markets broadly, but it's actually been this Magnificent Seven that's been a really, really key driver of markets.
I wanted to, when I was thinking, preparing for the podcast, I wanted to chat a bit further on what's been, you know, specifically on that interest rate scenario over the past couple of months. And I read a wonderful story a while ago, which, I managed to find, which was, those that will know American politics, maybe you've heard of James Carville. Now, James Carville was an advisor to the Bill Clinton presidential administration in the 90s. He was famously quoted as saying, I used to think, and I think he had a Southern American accent. I'm not going to try and impersonate it. Ben, you can have a go at it if you want to. But he said, I used to think it was, if there was reincarnation, I wanted to come back as a president or the pope or in American parlance, you know, a 400 baseball hitter, which is virtually an unachievable batting average. But now I want to come back as the bond market because you can intimidate anybody. So Ben, why is it that the bond market does dictate everything? And why is it having such a powerful impact at the moment?
Yeah, it's the most important price in the world, right? So the US 10-year yield is probably the most important number in financial markets, I guess. Why is that? It's because it's the return that every other asset class has to compete with. So if you can earn a good return in the 10-year, in US treasuries, obviously that makes, the hurdle for risk assets a bit higher. So if you can earn 4 or 5% in what they call a risk-free asset, that's pretty attractive, and it might mean you might want to earn more than that if you're going to earn if you're going to own a bit of risk in credit or equities or elsewhere. Why is it to the second part of your question, Nigel? Why is it having such a powerful moment right now? I think it sounds like a bit of a strategist cliche. I guess I am a strategist, so that's appropriate. Yeah. But it does feel like a paradigm shift, right? So it does feel like we are in a different macroeconomic and interest rate environment today than where we were just 12 months ago. So I think why it's on the front page as well as the business pages isn't just the level. You know, the level's very important. Again, if you've got a certain yield, every other risk asset has to compete with that. So it's always important. But the move we've seen, obviously, in the level, in where yields are, has been absolutely historic. Yeah. Over the last 9 or 12 months. And as I say, Nigel, that's why I think it's been front page news as well as business page news.
And just to go back to what you said, just in case anyone's not aware of it, why is it deemed the risk-free rate?
Well, that I see, I'll answer your question, then I'll go a bit off piece if that's okay.
No, go for it.
So why it's the risk-free rate is because the Americans will probably pay you back, right? So if you lend the American Treasury 100, they will probably pay you back interest along the way. And then when the bond matures, they'll probably pay you back the full 100 as well. So that's a risk-free asset. They pay it back in dollars. So if they were to get any trouble, they can just print more dollars. So it's really likely they're going to pay you back. And then obviously the dollar itself is the central, aspect, the central part of the global financial market liquidity economic system. So the dollar's at the core. The risk-free rate is therefore the U.S. Treasury. Again, they'll probably pay you back. Now, the bit that's off-piste is the dynamics of price. I'll tell you a true story that'll blow your mind. So maybe. So it's again, it's a risk-free asset. They will pay you interest and coupon, right? So that's very, very, very likely. But if you think about a 30-year treasury issued in 2020, so this is a bond the U.S. Government would issue in 2020, in my example, that they'd pay you back in 2050. Say along the way, they'd pay you interest, they'd pay the full back. So that was issued at 100, a price of 100, and is currently trading around 45. So what's quite interesting over the last two or three or four years is given the very significant increase in yields. And as they say on podcasts like this, yields move inversely to price, right? That's what they say, I think. So given yields have gone up, prices have gone down. And that's, I think, created quite a quandary for many financial market participants where the so-called risk-free asset, and again, it is a risk-free asset, they're going to pay you back. But the so-called risk-free asset can, the price can halve, is a little bit problematic, I think, and a question we are definitely pondering. You know, how do we think about what is supposed to be the safe asset if the price of it can move so dramatically and not necessarily in your favor? You know, something worth pondering, we think.
Sure.
So, I mean, your question, I was thinking about your question in relation to the power of bonds. How, why is it so important? And in terms of just almost like cause and effect, you know, I suppose over the many years I've just come to understand the bond. The bond is, as Ben says, it sets the price, right? Yes. But what is almost driving that setting of the price? Well, it's inflation, right? So pricing a bond at any given point in time reflects expectations of inflation. And so how does it change? Okay, so if, for example, more recently you get a data point which suggests inflation might be a little stronger than you feel, then inflation expectations change. Bonds sell off, yields go up. Okay, if yields go up, that means the price of money is going up. People will think about, market participants will think about it and say, actually, ooh, that may mean that the Fed may need to move short-term interest rates up because they'll try to quell inflation. So the price of money at both ends of the yield curve is going up. That means for a company, costs are going up, profits perhaps go down, and all of a sudden that flows to people saying, oh, should I be selling my equities? So it's the start point for a series of almost causal effects.
Cascading effects,
and it changes the narrative of the way people are thinking of the market and thinking of value. And I suppose that's the way I'm thinking about bonds as well. Hopefully maybe those two different ways of describing it helpful to our listeners.
Well, with respect to that, I guess it's the rise of interest rates has put pressure on everything, for lack of a better description. But from my perspective, standing here in October now, the year's been fairly positive, probably in comparison to 22, in a year that investors had to endure then. So I think my view has always been markets became probably far too pessimistic in 22. They've rallied hard. And then perhaps August, September to where we are now, then maybe they got a bit over their skis and have come off the boil a little bit. I guess I broadly talk about probably equity markets. We've had a number of clients ask us, is what's happening at this time of year normal? There's nothing normal in investment markets. But John, you know, from what you've encountered in your experience, is this what generally happens? And do you have any thoughts in terms of what could lead into the final quarter?
Yeah, well, I mean, the statistics will tell you it is what generally happens. September is statistically the month when markets have been down the most through history. And there's been some studies that I understand have been done that suggest that the reason why that is, and it's often that markets are dominated by the Northern Hemisphere. The Northern Hemisphere, you know, prior to September is the summer holidays. So people go away on summer holidays. There's also this effect that is almost good news gets translated into markets sooner and bad news takes longer. So actually people come back from holidays and then some of the bad news starts percolating and then it just flows into markets. That's supposedly the theory, but the data just simply says that September is the month that markets most often are down, and I don't think we should be particularly concerned about it. It's just, it's a bit like seasonality. So same sort of statistics suggest that the back half of the year, you know, from October onwards, are typically good. The sad part about it is that the last time we had a really big crash was back in 1987. I remember it, and there was a couple before that, like 1929 and 1907. Mm-hmm. They all occurred in October. We need to get our way through October, but once we get through October, typically the markets are stronger through the back half of the year. I honestly don't see any reason why we seem to be leading into any sort of crisis event in October. So for all of the fact that we've had a bit of a down month in September, you know, I think we shouldn't be feeling too concerned about
abnormal
the last part of the year.
Ben, any thoughts?
Yeah, similar look. How can I say? There's always human ingenuity, right? We're always having, not necessarily me, so this is a broad use of the word we, so when I say we, I'm referring to humanity writ large. We're having these good ideas, some of them come to market, and we get to invest in them. You know, equity markets are super cool, right? You get to invest in the companies of the future, which are going to sell the products and ideas, which are going to change the world in turn. So that's great. And I think, again, like looking back over the course of this year, it's been a really good example of that, where you could have, you know, it was reasonable to be worried about the broad outlook, tightening and, you know, geopolitical concerns, many things to worry about, all of which are real, for sure. And yet, you know, here we are through 23, and actually markets in the round, as you say, Nigel, have done a lot better than I think many were anticipating. So, you know, there's a real risk of getting too bearish. Right, you know, you can think about the nature of risk. If people say it's risky to be in markets, which is, I guess, true, but it's also risky to be out of markets. It's very dangerous as a investor if you miss the good days. Right, it's very, very clear. The math is very clear. If you miss the good days, that is seriously bad news for your longer term investment returns. And I, for one, don't feel totally confident. I know exactly when the good days are going to happen. If I could just be in the market on only the good days, I guess I'd do that. But that's hard. So I think 22, 23 may be another example of don't get too, if you can, I know this is hard, don't get too emotional in either direction, right? Not too euphoric and definitely not too despondent, because it's somewhat similar the other way around. But being over-invested, I guess, too far over your skis, to use your phrase. Yeah, definitely dangerous. Kind of everyone knows that. I don't think people are aware enough that also not being invested in risk assets is dangerous in a risk sense, because, again, if you miss those good days, it's properly bad news. It's not marginal. It's really, really bad news for you trying to keep up with your portfolio aims over time.
Nigel here, host of the ASB Investment Podcast. At ASB, we have a range of different ASB KiwiSaver Scheme fund options and ASB Investment Fund options that will suit our customers' goals and values. And we're excited to be expanding on these. Now, the big reveal we can do here is that ASB is launching new aggressive fund options that offer our investment customers a fund that will aim to achieve the highest investment returns of all of our ASB KiwiSaver Scheme and ASB Investment Funds over the long term. Now, this fund may suit those that are looking to invest for a longer time frame and are comfortable with potentially more movement up and down in their balance over time than our ASB growth funds. We have launched coming soon content on various ASB KiwiSaver Scheme and ASB Investment Fund web pages that will provide you with all the basic need-to-know information ahead of launch. We've also created an expression of interest form where you can register your details to then be contacted by our KiwiSaver and wealth experts once the fund is live. The ASB KiwiSaver Scheme and ASB Investment Funds Aggressive Funds cannot currently be applied for or acquired, and no money is currently being sought for investment in these funds. When the aggressive funds become open to investors, the offer of the funds will be made in accordance with the Financial Markets Conduct Act 2013. And now, on to the latest episode. Now, we're going to get onto a bit more detail on some of the things that the BII have been very focused on this year. And I've said in the podcast before about recommending people read their work and their outlooks. There was a really good one this week in terms of, I think, when you hear this, around the 12th of October. So it's great to have Ben in here to discuss these very things. The full year outlook this year had some key themes front and centre. Now, we're going to do a bit of a deep dive into a few of these now. The first one being holding tight. Markets have come around to the view that central banks will not quickly ease policy in a world shaped by supply constraints. And Ben, you and the BII team see them keeping policy tight to lean on and fight against inflation. We were discussing this earlier today. Why is this, fighting inflation above all else so important?
So firstly, I'd observe they've got to make a choice for the first time in maybe 15 years or more. So, central banks, mandates are different all over the world, but broadly, most central banks have a dual mandate. They're supposed to manage growth and they're supposed to manage inflation. And being a central banker, with all respect to my central banker friends listening out there, being a central banker during the Great Moderation was pretty easy because inflation was no problem. Right. So therefore, you could kind of just put a line through the inflation side of your mandate. It was no challenge. So you could focus on growth and you got to be a hero because anytime there was a growth wobble, you could stimulate and save the day. And there was no kind of downside because there was no inflation problem. We are now in a totally different set of circumstances where inflation is definitely a problem. So inflation is still much too high. And so now being a central banker is a much harder job, right? We should all have sympathy for Powell and others trying to manage this trade-off between, how much pain do you want to put through the economy, not because you're a nasty person, but because you now need to solve for the inflation bit as well for the first time in 15 or 20 years. So just a quick observation, it is a different situation where now they do need to think about both, right, for the first time in 15 or 20 years. And that's a challenge. Now, to your actual question, Nigel, why is inflation bad? As it's being called, it's the thief in the night, right? So it erodes the value of your savings, your hard work. You're out there, you've been working for 25 years, you put it in the bank, and you don't realize inflation is gently robbing you over time, just eroding the purchasing power. Like, that's a certain amount of money. But over time, if we have inflation, it can buy less and less and less stuff. So inflation is corrosive. It's socially disharmonious. It tends to impact the poorest the most, which is obviously its own social disaster, I guess. So it's a problem. And that's why Powell and other central bankers are taking it very seriously. And this is why I do think, again, it's not that they're nasty people, but they are going to be comfortable with a degree of a slowdown because they feel that's a price worth paying to try and keep inflation somewhat under control, I think, Nigel.
And that underpins the holding rates tight.
Exactly. Phrase. Exactly. So look, definitely, people focus on raising rates, which obviously is important. But now that we've raised rates quite a lot, quite quickly here in New Zealand, over in the US, most places in between, they can now kind of chill out a bit, right? So they may or may not do one more, but we're approximately there. But just because they stop hiking doesn't mean policy is somehow loosening, right? They're going to keep it tight. Mm. So monetary policy is already at a restrictive level. It's putting pressure on the economy. Again, that's not an accident, right? That's the purpose of the policy, is to put a bit of downward pressure on the economy overall. So they've really turned the volume on that up to 11, right? Moving interest rates in the US up to 5.5 so far. And they're going to leave them there to let the policy do its work.
Yeah.
Right. So, I use this weird jiu-jitsu metaphor. I do jiu-jitsu, which is a weird wrestling thing for those of you who don't know.
Of course.
So if you're wrestling inflation, right, let's say you get on top, you've done a takedown, 2 points, you've got on top, you're looking great. You don't let your opponent get up, right, it seems to me. Right. So you keep on top until you have absolutely won a glorious dynamic victory, right, which has basically never happened to me, but might happen to the other Powell. I think that's what he wants, is you don't declare victory too early and risk inflation getting up off the canvas and punching you back in the face. That's not allowed in jiu-jitsu, but maybe boxing metaphors are better here. So I think they're going to hold tight and really wait until they see inflation for mercy. Yeah. And we're just not there yet, I think.
Yeah. And your experience with interest rates we've talked about before in terms of...
Yeah, look, I agree that's the mentality that they'll have because they've got experience to look at, right? And if I just think back to the 70s, 80s and 90s, there was a number of false dawns and it just comes back and they have to, there's numerous recessions one after the other because basically they just couldn't tame the inflation, So I think that they've got that history that they're going to be looking back at. And so, yeah, I agree. They just... It could just be as just hold, not keep on raising, just hold, but holding is still tight, right? Mm. And so they're gonna keep it tight. Mm. They're gonna keep it tight as long as it takes, I think.
Now, pivoting ironically to the next theme, which has pivoting in its title, the past few years have had, our clients will know this all too well, I know this all too well, higher macro and market volatility. Everyone should be really familiar with that. It's brought to the forefront sort of more the need for, in some quarters, more dynamic and divergent security selection rather than just buying everything and holding. The BII sees this, you know, as pivoting to opportunities as such, you know, more granularity and more nimble picking of things tactically, potentially, while still getting you to your long-term goals. John, I'm going to ask you the first on this one. Can you explain what this means for listeners, whether they're seasoned investors or simply putting a portion of their earnings away every week in superannuation?
Yeah, so pivoting to opportunities is reflective of the fact that there is going to be volatility, there's going to be rotation in the market, right? So I think from an investor's perspective, a key thing to do is just continue to just to recognize that there is going to be continued volatility, so returns are going to be up and down. And so that means you're going to have to school yourself to your time frame. Just keep really, really focused upon what your time frame is. Your time frame's usually a lot longer than what you're reading in the media is indicating, right? Mm. And so you really need to school yourself not to react to that stuff, to keep your time frame long. I think Ben's probably going to, you know, be able to speak a little to some of the benefits of that long time frame. But I think the other thing is to, you're not the one that should be pivoting to opportunities. You've got a provider, you've got an investment manager, you've got ASB and BlackRock here who are looking after your money. That's our job, right? And we will be looking at the opportunities and we're trying to take advantage of the opportunities. The pivot to opportunities suggests more active management style is potentially going to be more beneficial, and that's something that we're looking at quite closely. So those would be my messages.
Yeah, look, of course, we agree, not least because
yeah, it's your theme.
It's our theme. So, yeah, funny enough, we're on board. We do think, I just want to make John's point kind of back to him and to the audience because it's really important, which is just to, you don't need to love it, but you need to accept that there is more volatility, right? It's just a fact, right? So there it is. And the response to that we would suggest is don't panic. That's not, you can if you want, if you enjoy that, you can, but it's not really that useful. It's to stay calm. Think about what you're trying to achieve. If you're trying to put your kids through college, fund your retirement, whatever, that's the focus. And to achieve that, you're going to need to stay consistent. And if that means, I don't want to sound, careless here, on the contrary, but if that means there's some short-term volatility, that can happen. But don't lose sight, as John's saying, of that long-term, your objective and the importance of staying in the market, staying invested so that you can get there over time. But there is the potential, we think, in a more complicated geopolitical, economic and policy kind of world, there is the potential for volatility. And as I say, that's something I think we're all going to have to learn to get a little bit more used to than we had to during the so-called the Great Moderation, when everything was a bit smoother sailing, I guess.
Yeah. And into our final point in terms of broad themes, the selectivity and sort of more granular focus really segues nicely into these mega forces. And I love reading about the mega forces because they're quite tactile and you can sort of, you know, see things happening around you that relate to them. But Ben, the BII's from the BII's standpoint, the five mega forces are what?
The five mega forces in no particular order. We've all got our favourite, but yeah. I'll do them in no particular order. So the energy transition. This idea that it's happening, right, that governments all over the world are allocating trillions of dollars into investments seems to be a fact, right? So that's just happening, the energy transition. Secondly, demographics, you know, huge, unbelievable, historic changes in, for example, the Chinese population. You know, some chance the Chinese population falls by a few hundreds of millions over the next several decades, which is, you know, unbelievable and definitely has implications for everything, including markets. Geopolitics, we call it globalization rewired. This idea, again, sorry about this, everything's getting a bit more complicated and we're going to move probably from just hyper-efficient supply chains away from that towards doing more business with our mates, bringing stuff home, countries we like. And again, politically, maybe that's a good idea, but it is probably going to cost a bit more. So those three, I introduced them in a bundle. Those are a little bit inflationary. So just by the way, that's kind of why we think inflation is going to persist. There are structural changes, which are mega forces, to use the brand, which are going to persist for years and even decades to come. Number four, We call it the future of finance. This is ideas, the idea that there's going to be a bit more lending done through capital markets, so more sort of private credit funds, that kind of thing, as banks, maybe this is more of an American comment, but banks come under a little bit of regulatory pressure and continue to be a little bit crimped, maybe still a hangover from the GFC there. And then lastly, of course, the one that's been, I guess, the superstar of 2023, we call it digital disruption. And it's, of course, the artificial intelligence kind of revolution. I don't think that's too strong a word. I have to say, I think it's going to change kind of everything relatively soon. So implications for all of our lives, maybe, but also definitely for markets, as we've seen play out in spades in 2023.
So we're nearly at the finish line, but I have a couple of my normal finale questions to wrap things up. And avid listeners will know, all of our guests get asked, and it's resulted in some really great answers. John, let's go to you first. What is something you're reading or watching that you can share with listeners?
Actually, I was thinking about this question, and recently I was I've been doing a little bit of reading and listening to some podcasts about China, and then it became about China and Taiwan, and that actually led to an understanding of the Straits of Malacca. Because a lot of what the China's thing is all about is about all of the trade that flows through the Straits of Malacca, which is below Singapore, where Ben is located. Right. And that then led me into the Suez Canal and the Panama Canal. And it's like all of a sudden I'm reading about the lifeblood of global trade. Basically, there's three places it all flows through. Then in the last podcast I was reading, it all actually came back to climate change, because actually the Panama Canal is having some real issues with the lakes in the middle drying up because it's too dry. So it's funny where you start and where you end up. But yeah, that's what's been interesting me recently.
A month or two spent listening to and finding out about canals. I love it. See, this is the great answers. It gives you such an insight into who the person is. Ben?
I'll give you two, if that's okay.
Oh, please.
As noted, I'm a cricket tragic. So the World Cup's on. So if you haven't seen Fire in Babylon, a fantastic documentary looking at the West Indian tour of the UK in 1976. You know, bouncers before helmets. Really scary. Yeah. Very, very scary.
Was that the first time of bouncers sort of being predominantly used or seriously used?
No, they've been around, but the West Indians were pretty good at it turned out.
Yeah. Not Malcolm Marshall, was it?
Joel Garner, Andy Roberts, Michael Holding, Whispering Death. What a nickname. My God, all-time nickname. So Fire in Babylon is, I think, one of the best sports documentaries ever. If you like cricket, it's even better. And if the World Cup's on, it's even better, I think. That would be one. Two, I'm a bit of a sci-fi nerd, I guess, maybe a nerd in general. So I'm reading, there's a story, a series of books by David Brin called The Uplift Series. And like all great art, these books are like 40 or 50 years old. And you read them and they're so fresh.
Yeah.
Yes.
It feels like, totally relevant to what's going on now with the AI thing. Anyway, I don't want to spoil it. No spoilers. But it's as I say, great art. It's 50 years old and it's still absolutely fresh. So enjoying those as well.
I read something a while ago, which was if you wanted a good glimpse into the future, you should read old sci-fi novels, because often than not, they have
totally
thought about.
Yes.
And some amazing inventions that have actually been delivered have been predicted in novels.
Yeah, very much so.
And so we've reached the end. I'd like to thank you both for stopping by, particularly Ben. I'm sure it's been a whirlwind trip. We were talking before in terms of your itinerary. It is makes us bankers' itineraries look light in comparison. It's been great having you here in person, and I hope we can do this again soon. John, thank you as always. And to our listeners, we'll be back in a few weeks with our next episode, so look out for that. We will be sharing a new announcement on that podcast and telling you a little bit more about it, so be sure to join us then. In the meantime, thanks for listening, and it's bye for now. Thanks for listening to the ASB Investment Podcast. If you have any thoughts on this episode, or if there's anything you'd like to discuss on a future show, get in touch with us at podcasts@asb.co.nz.
If you made it through the podcast and you're still listening, here comes the fine print. Interests in ASB KiwiSaver Scheme and ASB Investment Funds are issued by ASB Group Investments Limited. For more information, see the scheme's product disclosure statement available from ASB's website.